Tonight, a kind of self-indulgence for the old man. As regular listeners know, in real life, I am and have been for a long time a professor of social psychology. Tonight, I'm talking to another professor of social psychology who has written a book about yet another professor of social psychology far more famous in that discipline than either Tom Blass is or than I am. Thomas Blass is the author of the new book. Well, it was published last year. It's still very much available, and it has sold widely. The book titled The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. Shocked the world, of course, has a double meaning.
Right. Well, I happen to like puns, so Shocked the World has more specifically to do with the fact that his most famous work was built on a so-called shock machine, where people were induced to give increasingly more severe shocks, ostensibly as part of a learning procedure. It would be punished every time they made a mistake with increasing voltages of shock.
With an actor at the other end, disguised as a subject in the learning experiment, who begins, as the shock rises, to scream about the pain, the shock, the teacher, as he's called, is ordered, who's really the subject without his knowing it, is ordered by Milgram to raise the voltage higher and higher and higher, and many of the teachers protest, but most of them go on, to the point, to the end of the scale. Even when the actor playing the subject receiving shocks screams that he's got a weak heart and he can't take any more of this, he's still, the guy is ordered, go on, you must, the experiment requires that you continue. And the fact is that some 65 to 70% of the people put through this kind of procedure do go on administering what they take to be real and even dangerous shocks to victims.
Right, to an innocent victim who did nothing to deserve the punishment, simply at the behest of a gray lab coat wearing experimenter with a kind of vacant-eyed authority.
But this is done to begin with at Yale University.
At Yale University.
And the guy in the gray lab coat is Stanley Milgram.
Well, actually, if I may correct you, he was actually a hired hand. He was an experimenter. Stanley was hovering in the background and did some of the debriefing.
Oh, the experimenter was never Stanley?
No. Well, not in the main series of experiments. He was there to do the debriefing.
So this was done at Yale University to begin with.
Right.
So it had the extra glow of being endorsed by Yale.
Oh, sure. That certainly added to the power of the procedure. And, in fact, Milgram was aware of that possible limitation. So, as part of the series of the experiments, he actually did a couple of them, a couple of the conditions he carried out in Bridgeport, in a working class section of Bridgeport, without the trappings, without the aura of Yale.
But I want to crack through with a crucial question. If you go to the first runs of the experiment done at Yale, is Yale there somehow the equivalent during war years in Germany, the equivalent of Hitler or of the ministries in Berlin? In other words, Milgram's argument is authority, that seems to be legitimate authority, can bring people to do just about anything, canceling out their individual conscience. The great comparison that has been made again and again and was in Milgram's mind was that this is an experimental analog or an experimental duplication of the process that went on as thousands and thousands of SS personnel killed millions and millions of Jews and gypsies and lots of Poles and so on.
Right. Milgram, one of his motivations was actually to provide some perspective on how the Holocaust took place. How is it that a cultured nation got involved actively in the murder of 6 million Jews and others? He felt that there was a direct analog. My personal view is that Milgram's model fits only partially of the realities of the Holocaust.
Well, much of the argument about Milgram's work has concerned whether it is an effective analog, whether it does shed any real light on the Holocaust. Hannah Arendt thought that it did. Daniel Goldhagen dismisses it in half a page, saying it's irrelevant.
Right. Well, Daniel Goldhagen dismisses about 20 other theories, including Milgram's.
Sure.
But ironically enough, I think he hit on a point, that which is actually a deficiency in Milgram. Although I'm a Milgram advocate, I think where he falls short is that I think where he is on target in his model is an analog of the faceless bureaucrat who, instead of shipping apples to Bremerhaven, ships Jews to Auschwitz with the same degree of routinization. It does not account for the more zealous, hate-driven, vicious, degrading treatment and killing of Jews, which formed the heart of the Holocaust.
In my own social psychology class, the introductory big social psychology class, for years I taught, of course, Milgram studies, these obedience studies. He went on to do other fascinating work, and we'll talk about some of that later. But then, many years later, along came a fascinating book by Christopher Browning. He's one of the great scholars of the Holocaust, and I have in mind, of course, particularly his book, Ordinary Men, which is a study of a unit of the German military police, the Ordnungsbataillon 101, a bunch of guys a little bit older than the usual recruit from Hamburg, who supposedly weren't particularly Nazis, were supposedly sort of good guys, though they were many of them policemen in civilian life, now in the army, and they are ordered to add on their own labors to the general extermination program before the camps, the death camps, are opened up, when the Einsatzkommando have been killing by the hundreds of thousands, but more people are needed to do the killing. These guys are drafted, marched into one particular Polish village with a large Jewish population, and told, round these people up, march them out to the forest, they dig their graves, and we shoot them down. Then we go back into town to get more of them. The whole book of his, based upon German judicial investigation after the war, contains the testimony of these ordinary men who are in that police battalion 101. And there's and what we find there is, of course, that they were not particularly violently anti-Semitic. They were somewhat repelled by the initial orders, but authority demanded they go ahead and do it, and so they mostly complied, and they got used to it, and it became routine.
Yeah, it's interesting that you
mentioned... That seems to match Milgram, does it not?
Yes and no. It does, because they readily went along with it, and they were not ideologues. They were not up in the hierarchy. They were semi-retired men, ordinary men. However, they were steeped in the hate-driven Nazi ideology, which began in 1933 with the ascension of Hitler when he came into power, in which gradually, step by step by step, the Jews were dehumanized, were taken away from their jobs, that was certainly part of their being, so that it was not that difficult to take that step, even though, you know, and they were not part of the Einsatzgruppen, and they were not regular army people, they were not part of the Gestapo, but nonetheless, I think having been inculcated since 1933 through the propaganda machine with the hatred of the Jews, it was not that difficult. But well, it's interesting, can I just add one thing?
Please, yes.
The author of that book actually draws an analogy. He says, what I have here is a Milgram experiment.
Yes, he does.
In the field.
Chris Browning, in fact, has been on this program discussing these
right.
very matters
right.
a few years ago when that book first appeared. Going back to Milgram, though, who, after all, is doing his work in the 1960s, publishes these results in the 1960s, and at that time, you remember his famous statement you quoted in the book, of course, I can't find the exact quotation, you probably can in your book, where he says, from these studies, I now must regretfully conclude that an extermination camp could be staffed by people recruited from one middle-sized American city.
Right. I mean, I think he overstepped it a little bit, okay? Mm-hmm. I believe, and this is what he has not, in my judgment, stressed enough, is the role of ideology. He does talk about one of the ways that an authority can evoke destructive behavior from his subjects is through the subject accepting the definition of reality, which is sort of like there to some extent. However, he downplays ideology. He says, in fact, he says people without any hatred toward their victims can readily be caught up in a destructive process. That does not typify the typical Nazi extermination of Jews. These were not people without hatred. So, as I say, I think his model accounts for part of what happened. It accounts for the faceless bureaucrat, accounts for the 60 million people in Germany who were not involved in direct killing but stood around while their neighbors were taken away.
The process that he demonstrates in these studies is sometimes called, I don't know if Milgram actually used the term or not. Others have. It's called the Eichmann effect. Do these findings in some way account for Adolf Eichmann? Eichmann, after all, was the guy who made the trains run on time, delivering millions to their death in Poland.
Right.
But he wasn't dropping the gas into the death chamber.
Milgram felt that clearly he says something to the effect that I feel that Hannah Arendt's statement about banality evil comes closer to the truth than we might imagine, and in fact referring indirectly to Eichmann. In fact, Allport, who was one of the mentors, one of the greats of American psychology, in fact referred to the Eichmann effect. And interestingly enough, also the Japanese translation of the book is called the Eichmann Experiment. Yes, Milgram would say yes. This is Eichmann, the faceless bureaucrat. He saw his work as sort of providing the scientific underpinnings for the philosophical statements and observations of Hannah Arendt. Now,
I should be clear for those who don't know her work. This is Arendt's book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which is what exactly?
Well, she was an observer at the trial of Eichmann, and initially these were articles that appeared in New Yorker magazine, and they came out in a book form a year or two later. And her observation was, well, you know, in contrast to most views of Eichmann as a monster, he just seems like a plain bureaucrat, a faceless bureaucrat.
A bit of a mouse, she thought.
Yeah, who just simply was much more motivated in advancing his career than in killing Jews. Now, that has been contested, actually, and just to briefly mention, and I think she was fooled. My feeling is that she was fooled to some extent.
Fooled by his defense?
By his banality, by his plainness, because... In fact, right after a year after that book came out, there's a book that, by a historian called Jacob Robinson called "The Crooked and the Crooked Shall Be Made Straight," which was a refutation of Hannah Arendt, which included the fact that, in fact, the evidence suggests that he was very much of a zealous killer of Jews. He was not just the so-called desk killer. When Germany was losing the war, he preempted the trains, taking away from military troop needs to make sure that the Jews got to Auschwitz, even as Germany was losing the war. That's how zealous he was. So the idea of his being, capturing banality of evil is contestable.
So the question of how we are to understand human evil persists. It should be clear, and you make this very clear in this fine book that you've done, which is a biography of Stanley Milgram, to be sure, but also very much an examination of the evolution and the further development of social psychology in the post-war years down to the present. As you make clear in this book, Milgram represents what might be called situationalism.
Right.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to a so-called dispositional personality approach. But can I just take one moment just to talk about this nature of evil? I'm very much of an advocate. Obviously, I wouldn't have written a book. I mean, it's meant to be a balanced book. I believe he does speak to the nature of evil. We were discussing more specifically the analog to the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. He definitely enlightened us about the unexpected power of authorities to elicit behavior that people would not do when acting autonomously. And so we don't have to go to the Holocaust to find examples of that. We can go to Enron. We can go to, functionaries in Ford, in some auto manufacturer companies.
Are you saying that Milgram explains that better than he really, quote, explains the Holocaust?
I think so. Or whereas at least I think Holocaust can be contested, I think the more everyday, less exotic, if you will, instances of... being immersed in a hierarchy and bringing out the darker side of being a subordinate in a hierarchical organization.
And how does all of this bear? This whole conversation, which swirled around the Milgram studies, both his own contributions and the many commentators and so on,
right.
How does all of this relate to the question raised by the shadow in the famous opening of the great serial program, The Shadow? Who knows what evil lurks in the heart of man?
Right.
The shadow does. Do we know now what evil lurks in the heart of man, and what we should mean when we speak of evil lurking in the heart of man, and what do we know about what externalizes, brings out, activates those forces lodged in the heart of man?
Well, I think, as you were beginning to point out, I think one of the major contributions of Milgram is to enlighten us about the unexpected power of the situation.
Yeah.
We have this belief, I think, intuitively, that what kind of Our acts flow directly from the kind of people we are. If we're moral individuals, we act morally. If we're hateful sadists, we act in an evil fashion.
I do what I am.
Exactly.
I enact my nature.
Right. And his work contradicts that directly. What he's saying, we didn't need Milgram to tell us that we have a tendency to obey authority. What he enlightened us about is just how powerful this tendency is, so powerful that it can override our moral principles. So that whereas before Milgram, I think much of us, we believe that the only determinant, the major determinant of the kind of things we do are our inner, stable, dispositional, if you were, personality or moral qualities. What Milgram said is under certain circumstances, those moral principles can be trampled on. And that's essentially a major message of his work. I personally believe there's such a thing as evil. I don't think Milgram dismissed it. But what he enlightened us about is evil is not necessarily a stable, is not a product of inner characteristics only. It could be a product of external pressures operating on the individual.
Of course, you know, let me pose a problem even as we pause for some commercials. I would hope we might turn to this in further discussion right now. After 3 minutes of commercials, you know that there are trends in modern intellectual life, post-structuralism, post-modern interpretation, deconstructionism, Lacanian psychoanalysis. All of these is a big bundle, most of it from France, mm-hmm. But much absorbed by American academics and scholastics, which seems to argue it's a fiction when we assume there's anybody really at home inside, that the notion that there's a stable inner personality and inner values which persist across time, marking an individual, is in itself a construction of reality which has not necessarily much to do with reality. This is ultimate radical situationalism, which argues we are what we do, and we can be led to do all sorts of things that to many others will seem nasty, or we can be led to do many things that seem nice, and we will then rationalize and justify or use the justifications provided to us by those who have modeled our behavior to explain ourselves. But in fact, inside is a kind of an empty vessel. It rather reminds one of a theme in psychology which goes way back to William James. The James Lange theory of emotion is not I cry because I'm sad, but I am sad because I cry. That is, peripheral right. behavior mm-hmm. is interpreted as flowing from a deep emotion. This sounds very paradoxical and probably strange to some of the people listening, but this has been a serious debate, not merely within psychology, mm-hmm. but within the various disciplines that try to gauge mm-hmm. the nature of man. Mm-hmm. But the question I draw from all of this is, how then are we to conceive evil? Is it possible that evil is just a name we give to behaviors that, whether elicited from us or displayed by others, behaviors which we now are taught to condemn? Is it possible that we don't really have a deep moral sense at all? And I shall persist with that question after these words. And we return to Thomas Blass, who I should have made clear earlier is not only the author of the recent book, The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram, but is professor of psychology at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. And is a social psychologist of high repute for his own research and for your very considerable dedication to studying Milgram and his works and ways, his achievements, his influence, and reactions to him. We'll talk more about that shortly. But let me persist with the question I think I was raising before in that rather overheated passage. Taking all that's been said and done in modern intellectual life, mm-hmm. whether from the humanist scholars, whether from the semioticians and what have you, all of those weird French specialties, or from social psychology itself, mm-hmm. and from modern theology and moral philosophy, what do we now know about evil? Do we have any consensus as to why evil lurks in the heart of man, or if it does at all?
Well, let me sort of step back a second. The way you phrased it, in terms of there's nothing in there, it's like Skinnerian.
I wasn't asserting that. I was saying that's one position.
That's one position. I think certainly Milgram would not have endorsed it, number one. Number two, the evidence against it actually comes from Milgram himself. When we talk about the majority, remember the surprising number of people who went along punishing extremely, perhaps even in a deadly fashion, the learners in the experiment, what we also have to keep in mind is that 65%, there were 35% of the people who disobeyed. Now, where did that come from? These are people who bucked the tide. Where does the source of bucking the tide of evil pressures come from? It must have come from inside. So to say that it's all from the outside and we kind of rationalize, I think is definitely an overstatement, number one. Number two, there's a whole literature, and it has become more and more refined, that shows that personality variables, that is, tests based on self-reports, do predict behavior. Now, these are meant to be assumed to be stable characteristics of the individual, which are measured, tapped mm-hmm. by the self-report measures, introversion, extroversion, or even attitude measures. Attitudes can predict behavior. Personality can predict behavior. Well, these are things that predict behavior cross-situationally, not as widely, as powerfully as one thought, because there was a whole controversy early in psychology stirred up by a personality theorist named Walter Mischel. But at this point, we are there's a sort of rapprochement in social psychology where more and more, although the situational emphasis dominates, there's a recognition that it's important to take into account both the situation and the fairly stable personality characteristics. So to say that somebody is, you know, it's an empty vessel, well, there's a personality there. And that personality, if you measure it well, can in fact predict behavior.
Imagine that at this table, sitting in that chair over there, I'm pointing to mm-hmm. something which triangulates to where we are, is sitting Dr. Rudolf Schlemmerheimer of the Chicago Psychoanalytic Institute.
Mm-hmm.
That's a made-up name. But he's a Viennese. He's quite old, but he's still quite intact, and he's sort of the senior man, much honored, at the Psychoanalytic Institute. What would he say if he joined this conversation at this point?
Oh, he definitely would be a very strong advocate of an inner-driven source of behavior that is based on the vicissitudes of developmental events, beginning with childhood. Basically, a Freudian would argue that it's your development, the product of your developmental process, is you.
But a Freudian would also argue, going back to the documents of the master, going back to the canonical source, could also argue that there is a built-in death instinct, a built-in source of hostility, rage, and destructiveness. Eros is love, and can be transformed into all sorts of constructive and creative outcomes. Thanatos, the death instinct, is essentially the instinct to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And we are tempted to destroy ourselves. Defensively, we put that target aside, and we choose the target of others, and we take great pleasure in injuring others, even in killing others, though to be sure some people, by virtue of the vicissitudes they've been through, may have stronger thanatos urges than others, but it's there as a deep well of destructiveness that flows from a man himself.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think...
Is that nonsense?
It's not nonsense, but it doesn't have much standing in academic psychology. And in fact, Milgram, although I think we don't have time for this, but it's worth reading either my book or his own book, where he actually pits his view what he found, the destructive actions of his subjects, were a product of the pressures of authority rather than pent-up hostilities being allowed to be expressed by the permissive environment of the experiment. So that, yeah, I mean, there's a viewpoint. I don't endorse it. I mean, I don't think that... we're born with evil in our hearts. Doesn't say that some people are characterologically sadistic, evil. There's no those entities exist. But academic psychologists have had a hard time dealing with Freudian concepts because they're very difficult to test.
I confess that I am one academic psychologist who long since put them aside as essentially non-scientific, and where they generate predictions, the predictions are usually more often disconfirmed than confirmed.
Right. By the way, if I may interrupt for a second, I want to share with the audience the fact that Milt Rosenberg has a special relationship to Milgram, and it's a delight for me to be here because he was a colleague of Milgram early on when Milgram came to Yale.
A dumber colleague. Stanley was the smartest.
Well, I wouldn't say that because, in fact, in my teaching in social psychology, I draw on quite frequently on Milt Rosenberg's ideas. So it's a real pleasure to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. And in fact, that leads directly to what I wanted to go to next. This book of yours, which is certainly a fine biography of a very interesting man, whom I knew because we overlapped only for a year or two at Yale, and then our paths separated. He went to Harvard, I went on to Ohio State for two strange years, and then to Dartmouth, and then to the University of Chicago. Though indeed, I saw Stanley occasionally over the years. At one point, he came and did a major colloquium for us at the University of Chicago in the late 70s, I think. But be all that as it may, what one also gets from your book is a sense of the evolution of a particular sub-discipline of psychology, experimental social psychology particularly. I hereby invite you to talk about that. It fascinates me to get your interpretation of just how the field that I've been laboring in for so long actually emerged. Half of the people you talk about in this book are people I've known.
Right. Well, social psychology tends to study social, everyday, normal social behavior in a systematic way, preferably using the experimental design, the laboratory experiment that began. The father of social psychology was a fellow named Kurt Lewin, a German-Jewish immigrant to the United States, came when the Nazis took over. In fact, he beat them to the punch. Before he was thrown out of his university, he left knowing what was coming. Anyway, what social psychology did and what Lewin showed was that you can take amorphous ideas and sort of place them in the bottle of the laboratory, so to speak. One of his classic experiments was on studying leadership styles. Now, he talked about things like group atmosphere, leadership styles. He created a boys' club in which different leaders carried out different styles of leadership, authoritarian or democratic, and see what effect it had on the children's
behavior.
And the
third style was laissez-faire,
right, in between, kind of a hybrid. And this was, according to a historian of psychology named E.E. Jones, he referred to this experiment as having a creative audacity, because this was the first time, one of the first times, where concepts which we normally don't think have any concrete reference, feelings, moods, atmosphere, got translated into actual operational, if you will, definitions. So it began with him, but the whole effort of social psychology is take the basic fabric of everyday behavior and go beyond intuition, go beyond folklore, and test ideas systematically, either using preferably the powerful tool of the experiment. I say powerful because an experiment has the ability to allow us to infer cause and effect relationships.
But one curious thing about the new social psychology, which developed certainly in the wake of or influenced strongly by Kurt Lewin's work, and then the group of his students who fanned out, one of them was
Leon Festinger.
Was Leon Festinger. Another was my professor. Well, Festinger was my professor at Michigan, where I got my doctorate, as was Ronald Lippitt, who was another one of those Iowa guys.
He was a co-author on the leadership study.
He was indeed, yeah. But what that experiment that you referred to illustrates already is something which characterizes experimental social psychology from that point on to the present. So many questions and problems have arisen about this central fact. The fact is that those experiments involve, quote, deception.
Yeah, it's an irony. It's actually a paradox in a way. Not all of them, but some do. That is deception. What do you mean by deception? Milgram never liked that word. He called it illusion, but nonetheless, it is the word that's used in mainstream social psychology.
He told the guys who were administering the shocks that they were not subjects, they were helping them do an experiment.
Right, and we're trying to learn something about the relationship between punishment and learning.
All of which was untrue.
But it's one of the ironies of social psychology. In order to get to the truth, you have to actually deviate from the truth. Why is that? Because much of the substance of social psychology has an evaluative component. If I ask my class to take a blank piece of paper and tell me which of the two characteristics, who are you? Are you an obedient or conforming individual or independent-minded? I don't have to be a prophet to know that 99% of my responses would be as I am independent-minded. In our society, to be yielding, to be obedient is not a value judgment. So the point is, much of the substance of social psychology is behavior that has an evaluative aspect to it. And so if you told people the truth, they're going to act not in the way they genuinely act candidly, but in the way they think you want them to act.
Let's illustrate that just a bit. Name two or three other well-known experiments that involve deception.
Okay. The other, another classic one, which is often spoken in the same league as Milgram, is, in fact, his mentor, Solomon Asch. Solomon Asch did a classic experiment on conformity. And what he did was, he was troubled by a prevailing view of human nature as people being rather malleable, suggestible, and so he decided to test it empirically in a very concrete, measurable way. He set up an experiment ostensibly dealing with visual perception. The basic idea was very simple, a hallmark of his style. He was a combination of a person with deep philosophical bent with a very uncluttered experimental style. What he did was, he brought subjects to the laboratory, told them, we're doing a study in visual judgment. The idea is this. We're going to have a number of trials. In each trial, you're going to have in front of you two boards, and on one, you're going to have three lines of different lengths, vertical lines, and the fourth one... on the other board, another line. Now, that fourth line matches one of the three in lengths. What I want you to do is tell me, on each trial, which of the three lines that fourth line is equivalent to. Normally, there would be five or six people in the room, and he would go around, each person would say in turn. Now, the experiment begins quite normally. People say, okay, well, everybody looks at it, looks, it's like one is the correct alternative, and everybody says one, 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 and the sixth subject says one.
Because it's the correct order.
Now, about second or third trial, something odd happens. Everybody looks at the stimulus lines, and the last person around the room, around the table, thinks, hey, you know, that's alternative C. So he waits for his opportunity to say that. So the first person says two, second says two, 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 two. By the time it comes to him, he's saddled with a dilemma. What does he do? He sees that it's three, and yet five or six other people who are presumably sane and see the same world as he does are giving incorrect answers. What Asch found, that on the average, about a third of the trials, these so-called critical trials, the last person was the only naive subject. The others were in cahoots with Asch, who were instructed to give incorrect answers unanimously on designated trials. What Asch found, to his surprise, that an approximate third of the time, their naive subject went along with the false consensus, bogus majority, and yielded and gave the incorrect answer despite the fact that he knew that it was wrong. So basically, here we have something that, you know, people have speculated about all the time. Are we yielding people? Philosophers, this has been an old question. Are we malleable? Are we pliable? Well, Asch decided to attack this question empirically. And he found that, in fact, it depends how you look at it. Is the bottle half full, half empty? Most of the time, people stayed independent, but the surprise was that even a third of the time, people went along in a situation that was blatantly inconsistent with their view of the world. So that's a classic. And to get back to your initial point about deception, if you would have told them, hey, I'm measuring conformity, folks, how many people would actually go along? Zero. He had to tell them of necessity, and nobody likes to lie. And by the way, usually subjects are debriefed, virtually every time, at so-called debrief. They're given the truth and at the end of the experiment. He had to tell them, he had to have a cover story, because if they knew that he was measuring conformity, you would not get it, because in our society, conformity is not a valued, it's a disvalued quality. What we value in others is independence of judgment. So he had to sort of divert attention from the true purpose to get valid data.
While Stanley Milgram was doing the studies we've been discussing, I was doing studies at the same university involving training subjects to achieve deep hypnosis. I wasn't doing the hypnosis. A psychiatrist who was a specialist in hypnosis worked with me on this. And then suggesting to them that some of their attitudes, which had been pre-measured, would go through decisive change. Mm-hmm. One was, how do you feel about the city of Los Angeles? And if they like the city of Los Angeles, the hypnotic suggestion was, when you wake, you'll feel loathing and disgust at the very idea of living in Los Angeles. But you won't remember having been told this, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then you wake them up, and supposedly they don't remember. Whether they really do or don't hangs on the question of what you think hypnosis is really about and how it really works. But what you do get under those circumstances is, when you now retest the attitude, you get basic shift in stated evaluative response. They earlier said, I love Los Angeles, +4 on a scale from -5 to +5, and then he comes out saying, I dislike Los Angeles, -5 on a scale of +5 to -5, but More interestingly, he then reorganizes all of his thought about what you find in Los Angeles, what's bad, though he used to talk about what's good about Los Angeles. This is done systematically with proper measures of a cognitive structure as well as the affective response. I mention this because clearly a very basic deception is involved as well. When we did that study, it was our thought, among other things, to test out whether this might have been a technique used in the brainwashing of American prisoners. I don't know that we proved anything of the sort, but we did prove that a hypnotic suggestion, which is supposed to shift affect, will produce a consistency-seeking reorganization of the cognitive surround of the affect. But it's utterly deep deception. These kids thought they were engaged in a study of hypnosis, and some other experimenter was doing some work testing their attitudes. The subjects were all graduate students and or medical students at Yale, and of course, eventually, they are disabused and told what was really going on. Just as Stanley Milgram's experiments aroused a great deal of concern from the Ethics Committee of the American Psychological Association, one leading fellow on that panel, also whom I knew anyway, Stuart Cook, of New York University, sent me a letter saying, "Now there are some ambiguities about what you're doing. How do you defend doing it this way?" There was a concern, and a proper concern, that maybe people were being manipulated far too potentially injuriously.
Well,
and that concern was very basic with regard to Milgram, was it not?
Oh, yeah, that was more of a concern. I from what you describe, although I'm not an expert in hypnosis, I don't see it having enduring after effects, I mean, to the extent that you debrief them. I think the bottom line is, I think at the time that you did it, at the time that Milgram did it, people were operating in an ethical vacuum. I don't think we were the requirements of for protection of human subjects were not institutionalized as they are now.
The Ethics Committee of the APA really wet its teeth on the Milgram studies.
Well, actually, it was actually membership. There was, it's a little, his membership was suspended, application for a year, while they had a chance to evaluate it. But, yeah, there was some ethical group with an APA, but it did not reach formalization until the 1970s. So, very often, yes, it was there, but it was a more informal structure. And, in fact, Milgram, among half a dozen controversial experiments, was really the stimulus for the increased regulation and standardization of research ethics.
Well, what has come to be the case, and this also involves the interests of universities, is that no experimental design, at least in social psychology, possibly in any field, can be carried through until first cleared by a research ethics committee of the university.
Exactly. It's something called the Institutional Review Board, which is mandated, was mandated by a research legislation, the research in 1975, so that in order, initially it was just for federally supported grants, but now it's everything. You have to go at our university, go through an institutional review board. Depending on the potential for risk, there are different gradations of severity, of meticulousness of a review. And actually, it's been a backlash, not in the psychology. I mean, I believe that there is a necessity for it. Although would be hard to find a case of in psychology, purely behavioral experiments, a documentation of any long-term aversive effects of subjects. Now, I'm not talking about biomedical research, where clearly there's a need for it.
Well, we come back to Milgram's famous obedience studies. There were, in fact, how many studies in all?
Over 20.
Over 20, with varying such a number of particular experimental factors, one being the proximity of the shocked to the shocker,
right.
Various others. But essentially the same effect shows up in all of those studies.
The amount of obedience varies depending on certain features of the situation.
Yeah. The closer you bring the sufferer to the man administering the shocks, the more resistance to administering shocks.
Exactly.
Which raises the question of why you didn't have guards in the extermination camps who when told to drop the gas into the death chamber, why you didn't get some people refusing to do it.
Why they didn't refuse to do it?
As far as I know. As far as I know, I've never heard of any such case.
Well, first of all, that would be consistent with Milgram. In fact, they were not that close. They were up on the roof.
Well, to be sure, they're dropping it through.
They were not in a hole
in the roof.
They were not in direct contact with the victims. But again, we're talking about a deeply rooted ideology that drove them, and that I think was a dominant force.
But coming back to Milgram and his story, apparently he had a hard time in terms of there was much fascination with his studies, but also a barrage of criticism coming from many different directions.
Right. Well, I think one was clearly the ethical issue. He sort of pushed the proverbial envelope, even though, as I say, at the time he was operating an ethical vacuum. But to his credit, actually, in his so first of all, the amount of stress he created was quite unusual. If you look, there's a black and white documentary which vividly provides a visual companion piece to his written work. You can see the visible signs of stress: people biting their lips, digging their nails into their flesh, stuttering, stammering, inappropriate laughter. No question, there was a high degree of stress with many subjects during the experimental hour. To Milgram's credit, though, number one, he actually put in his grant application that he would be careful about making sure that subjects leave in a state of well-being. And he did that, the so-called debriefing. He, by the way, historians of psychology say that he was the first to use the term debriefing in a non-military sense.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, here's something that, as far as I know, has not been done to the present day. He sent a questionnaire, a follow-up questionnaire, to find out about the well-being of the subjects. He asked them, for example, how sorry, how glad were you to be in an experiment? This was anywhere from 2 months to a year after they had participated. And to most people's surprise, because you have a lot of urban myths today about this, roughly 84% of the people said they were glad or very glad to have been in the experiment, and it went very sorry, 1.4%.
Well, there were some follow-up studies, of course. Paul Herrera, who was a psychiatrist at Yale, did one follow-up study, and he found the sort of thing you're talking about.
Right. I spoke to Paul Herrera, by the way.
Yeah.
And, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But weren't there some other follow-ups which supposedly gave a different view?
I'm not aware of any.
Well, there was certainly a paper, as and you talk about this in your book, by Diana Baumrind.
Okay. Well, she was a purely conceptual critique. I don't think
she didn't talk to any of the subjects.
As far as I know, she never talked to any subjects. She was the first one, at least in the journals, although it was preceded, ironically, by an editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch criticizing Yale and Milgram. But by Diana Baumrind was the first one to raise the ethical issues in scholarly forum. She raised two issues. Number one, what right did you have to deceive subjects? Number two, what right did you have to put them into an unanticipated stress situation, which could have prolonged effects on their self-esteem, on their ability to trust people? And what right did you have to create this kind of distress? And so she started what was to become an ongoing debate to the present day, actually.
The other line of criticism was the one that we talked about earlier tonight, the argument that this experiment doesn't translate to real life. The experiment doesn't have any external validity in the technical sense. Martin Orne, whose critique you also talk about in your book, made that argument strongly.
Right. Besides the ethical argument, there were other more arguments, including interpretation. I mean, Milgram felt that he has demonstrated destructive obedience, not only in laboratory, but in any situation where a person willingly becomes an instrument, an agent of an authority. He argues that at that point, once you accept the legitimacy of authority, anything goes.
You've seen me tinkering with the computer in front of me. I must read you a story.
Okay.
I went looking for this. This is from NewScientist.com, dated November 2004. All humans are capable of committing torture and other, quote, acts of great evil. That is the unhappy conclusion drawn from an analysis of psychological studies. Over 25,000 psychological studies involving 8 million participants support this finding, say Susan Fiske and her colleagues at Princeton University in New Jersey, United States. The researchers considered the circumstances surrounding how individuals committed seemingly inexplicable acts of abuse in the midst of the U.S. military's torture of Iraqi inmates at the Abu Ghraib prison. And a quote, could any average 18-year-old have tortured these prisoners? I would have to answer yes, just about anyone could have, says Fiske. And he goes on to review the studies. This is a meta study The number of separate studies, 25,000, amazed me.
That number amazes me also. I'm familiar with the article. Susan Fiske, she's a brilliant social psychologist. I think what she's saying has some truth to it. But again, what she overlooks is the fact that in all cases where you, and I think she was basing it on systematic studies and then extrapolating to Abu Ghraib, is that in all cases, it's not a 100% unanimous, uniform kind of act. As in Milgram's experiment, as I say, 65% were willing to go along, and 35 did not. And we can, in fact, extrapolate to Abu Ghraib. We had people, whistleblowers. We had people, what was his name, this private who blew the whistle. We had people, in fact, very much congruent with Milgram. Well, the heart of what happened there certainly is congruent with Milgram's work. But at the same time, other parts are also.
Happened there and what happened in Bosnia and what happened in Kosovo and what happened in Rwanda, what happened, for that matter, earlier on in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. All of these involve genocidal activity in which one group defines itself against another group and kills members of the other group on a systematic basis.
Right. It's hard to, you know, I'm not sure if Susan Fiske was attempting to account for all those atrocities and all those situations, but I think
she seems to be saying
you
can account for it by the capacity of people following situational redefinition to follow orders and commit acts of destruction.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the revelatory power of Milgram's work is that he found the level of destructive acts that are committed that we didn't think would be committed by normal individuals against innocent people.
It really is a finding that shakes you.
It does
shakes
shake
one
you.
Up.
And in fact, and he in fact went to great lengths to demonstrate the revelatory power by contrasting what he found with expectations. For example, he described his experiment to a group of psychiatrists. They were actually residents at Yale. And he told them what he did, and he asked them to predict how many subjects would actually go along to the top of the shock scale, which was ostensibly 450 volts. He found that they answered that less than 1% of the people would be willing to inflict this most severe shock. So there's no question that he taught us something we didn't know. How far we can extrapolate to different situations, I think each of them has its own dynamic, and certainly we have ethnic hostilities. There's a tendency of in-group, out-group.
What did they make of Milgram studies in Germany in those years? Do we know?
I should
think they might have welcomed them.
I honestly don't know at the time. Well, let's put it this way. Very soon after, somebody replicated in Germany with actually slightly higher since 1971. But at the time, I know that it got international attention. I'm not aware of what Germans thought of it at the time.
Of course, Milgram aspired to replicate in some other countries.
Right. Initially, he had sort of dual purpose. Number one, to have to study obedience experimentally. And secondly, actually do a comparison to Germany.
He never got around to that.
In fact, he felt it was not necessary because he found so much obedience in the United States, he didn't feel necessary to go to Germany.
We are about to pause for a round of commercials and then on to a quick newscast. And shortly we'll be getting on to the telephones. The number is, as ever, 591-7200. And the lines are open and available to you at this instant. 591-7200. We return after this. We are talking tonight about the work of one brilliant social psychologist, Stanley Milgram, and his experiments, which in a way illuminate the human capacity for doing pretty dreadful things to other human beings when ordered by authority to so behave. Those experiments done some years ago ring down through succeeding decades, and they are relevant to a general discussion of further instances of genocide as they have occurred since World War II. Our phone number is 591-7200. We'll be on to your questions and or comments in about 10 minutes. So if you want to join us, now's the time to give us a call, 591-7200. If you are listening on the Internet at some greater distance and want to join us by email, the email address is, of course, equally as ever, extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720, as one word, at tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E.com, or 591-7200. Let us turn to the man. A good part of this fine book of yours, which has had very, very strong endorsement by all sorts of relevant critics, not merely psychologists, but literary figures and so on. A good part of this book, The Man Who Shocked the World, is about the man himself. Interesting fellow, to say the least.
He was interesting, and that's why one of the main reasons I was drawn to do a biography. Before I did the biography, I sort of did what Milgram did. I spent about 10 years doing things like writing literature reviews and of the obedience experiments, of his other work, and all kinds of so-called more scholarly stuff. But then I came to discover what a fascinating person he was. So, and then I thank my wife for this, because she was pushing me into this. Mm-hmm. He told me, he's so interesting, why don't you write a book about him? So you're asking what kind of person he was. He was complex. I found it a major challenge to capture the complexity of the person, because he was, in many ways, his characteristics, there were polar opposites in him. He could be loving, kind, nurturing. At the same time, he could be petty, nasty, and in fact, I've spoken to dozens of his students, and I get the reactions I get. There was no middle ground. There were extremes. Either they loved him or they hated him. I mean, I had one student who told me that she was writing a dissertation, and she was in tears because she was spending hours and hours at her computer, and told this Milgram, I'm going to go crazy if I have to do this anymore. He was her mentor. So he says, okay, well, next day he pulls a computer into his office and has her sit down and says, okay, why don't you continue doing your analyses over here? So meanwhile, she's sitting in there. Her name is Rana Kovacnik. She's in California. She's doing her analysis. Milgram, meanwhile, is answering his mail, answering his phone, talking on the phone, and she's there. On the other hand, his brother comes by one day and is waiting to see him, and he sees this female student bolting out of his office in tears. So they're both sides of him. Difficult to capture the kind. Plus, he was, despite, we have this image, he did one of the most sinister pieces of work, and one can kind of characterize it that way. He was a very playful individual. He was multifaceted. Many of the other things that he did were featherweight by comparison.
Well, they're very innovative, all the same.
Yeah, all were
and
innovative.
It's really fun in games.
Right, exactly. He was very game-like in many of his...
Describe some of the other studies.
Well,
these are after the obedience work.
These are after the obedience work, because that set the stage, okay? One is called, for example, the lost letter technique. Mm-hmm. And it actually dealt with a serious issue, which is when you do an opinion poll, let's say usually face-to-face or over the phone, a survey, you run into so-called interviewer bias. People might give you the responses that they think you want to hear. Well, he eliminated that by actually eliminating the human element. What he did was he dropped letters throughout New Haven addressed to recipients of different degrees of likability. Friends of the Communist Party, friends of the Nazi Party, a fictitious but laudable medical research associate, and a private individual. And he waited for 3 weeks to find, and they were addressed. They were scattered on the streets, on sidewalks, and phone booths, by cars. Waited 2-3 weeks and see how many came in. Here, this was a so-called non-reactive or unobtrusive measure of attitude, of community attitudes. And what he found was, this was kind of a test of the procedure. He found that 75% of the communist, 25% of communist, pro-communist, pro-Nazi letters ended up being mailed, and 75% of the medical research associates and the benign and the individual were mailed. So it had playful quality. In fact, he retrospectively says, I wonder why I got into this. It must have been because of the poetry of it. But he was that kind of person. He was a neo-Renaissance man.
I give the title of a famous play, Six Degrees of Separation, that traces back to Stanley Milgram.
Exactly. And Six Degrees of Separation, Milgram actually never used that term, but that's what we know it by. Ironically, that's how it reentered public discourse. He conducted a study called to test the so-called small world phenomenon. A couple of mathematicians in the Cambridge area came up with a mathematical model predicting that you could connect elements of a large, large, large network with a very parsimonious small number of links. And he decided, okay, this is a theoretical, mathematical. He was very much of a hands-on empiricist, a concrete behavior.
Often without theory.
Without theory, exactly. Yeah. He was curious, okay, this is a theoretical concept, does it work in real life? So he tested it. He got a bunch of so-called starters in Nebraska, said, I'd like you to take this letter and get it to this person in Sharon, Massachusetts. You don't know him.
But it's got to be hand-delivered.
It's got to be hand-delivered. The rule was
you give it to somebody.
You have to give it to somebody whom you know on a first-name basis.
Uh-huh.
So when he was asked, you know, he asked people, well, how many links do you think I need to get to this stranger in Sharon, Massachusetts? Well, most people, 50, 60. It turned out that of those that were completed, typically it was something like 6 intermediate links that it took to reach the stranger. So in other words, here we have the small world phenomenon, and it had a game-like quality. I mean, it was, you know, like, you know, sending letters, like a pyramid or whatever. But no, this had a much more serious purpose. Now, what's interesting about this is that it has, first of all, it re-entered through the strange gateway of this play called 6 Degrees of Separation, which clearly was grounded in that idea. But what's even more important is that it turns out that Milgram really discovered in this kind of parsimonious rule, the small world rule, that large networks can be traversed through a swath of a short number of links, actually has stepped over into the realm of the physical domain. Two applied mathematicians at Cornell, Watts and Strogatz, wrote an article in Nature showing that this parsimonious small world principle applies even in the physical domain. In something like looking at the grids, electric grids of the Western United States, follow the small world rule. The synapse connections of certain amoebas has the same properties. So unwittingly, Milgram actually discovered a much more fundamental truth about our world, going beyond purely social
networks.
How can
that truth be stated in generalized form?
The generalized form is that we can take very large networks and connect the different nodes of them in a much shorter, with a much shorter number of links than one would intuitively believe to be the case.
It's fascinating work, and indeed, in some ways, it's...
And it has wide implications. Strogatz, the way he put it is the renaissance of Milgram's idea, and strangely enough, it's not in psychology. It's in other domains, in computer science, and applied mathematics, and physics. Finding that this principle of parsimony that Milgram discovered applied to social networks is not just a peculiarity of social networks, but seems to apply more widely to networks of all sorts.
It is interesting speculating on his career and relating it to the sociology of academic life in this country. He's generally regarded by historians of social psychology like you, and yet others, surely, as one of the 2 or 3 most significant social psychologists of the post-war period. He went from Yale, where he was a very assistant professor, to an appointment at Harvard, where he was still ranked as assistant professor, and he did not get tenure. And he had trouble finding... He spent how many years, 4 or 5, or was it only 3?
He was there from 1963 to 1967.
At Harvard?
At Harvard, yes.
And then Harvard wouldn't keep him, and he was looking for another job, and he wasn't really satisfied with the job he finally took,
right?
Which was at the City University of New York.
Right. He was hoping that if he had to leave Harvard, and he loved Harvard, he called it Academic Eden,
sure.
And it was a tremendous disappointment. He was literally depressed when he did not get tenure. And apparently it was a residual feelings about the ethics of the experiment,
yeah,
plus some other reasons, but there was a main factor, which he thought was really already past, you know, beyond
the guy
that,
who got that position instead, Bob Rosenthal.
Bob Rosenthal
is an old friend of mine, and he and I have done some work together.
Oh, right. Anyway, so he was hoping if he had to leave it, he would, you know, maybe go to Stanford, University of Chicago,
yeah,
Berkeley. He didn't get a job. And the reason was very simple. In any prestigious university, you have to have a majority vote. It's not just fiat of the. And he would, by that time, he was so controversial that it was virtually impossible to get a majority. It was so controversial that typically a department would be divided about him. So he ended up at CUNY, City University of New York, which was not a prestigious program, but he managed to, he landed a position, he was given the position as head of a new social psychology program. And if you were an objective outside observer, you'd say, hey, this is a plum. He went from a lecturer, which had an assistant professor, to full professor, doubling his salary, heading a program, being able to do his own thing, without any, and in fact, it turned out to be, and that's where he stayed until he died. In my opinion, those were his most productive years. But as you quite correctly pointed out, it was not his first choice. He didn't anticipate staying there that long.
Sadly, he died quite young. How old was he? 50?
He was 51.
Just 51.
Right. He had a series of heart problems beginning in 1980, and he died in 1984. Mm-hmm. And but he managed to persist. What was amazing about him is that he didn't let it hold him back. Even by the last, he taught in the fall of 1984. He died in December of 1984. In the fall of 1984, he was still carrying a full load, like a regular faculty member.
And also, we haven't talked about this at all. He was involved in making films.
Oh yeah,
he had a whole new exciting interest,
right,
serving his artistic needs.
Right. Actually, Milgram thought of himself as a neo-Renaissance man, and in a couple of places he always saw himself as a social psychologist as one of his many identities. He says, "When I do social psychology, I'm a social psychologist. When I'm a filmmaker, I'm a filmmaker." In fact, it's interesting. One of his biographical reference books, I saw the questionnaire, and asking occupation, he put down social psychologist and filmmaker. And he produced films which are still shown today. I show them, excellent educational films, prize-winning films, including a film called The City and the Self, which actually was a visual companion piece to some scholarly work that he was doing. He introduced, one of the people introduced a subdiscipline of called urban psychology, looking systematically at the ways that behavior becomes transformed in the urban setting as compared to life in smaller towns.
What are the findings in that realm?
In general, among the main findings is that people are more helpful in smaller towns than in, in larger cities. He derived it actually going back to Wirth, a sociologist who talked about certain demographic qualities that large metropolitan locations have. High density, overcrowding, heterogeneity of population. What he did was essentially took those non-psychological concepts and distilled them into what he calls stimulus overload. He felt that what's happening in city and living in cities is that we're bombarded by more stimuli than we can handle, and so we have to, our behavior that changes is represents our way of dealing, coping with the overload.
I wonder if he was influenced, he must have been, by the work done in New York at the same time by Latané and Darley.
Well, it's
interesting. Starting with the Kitty Genovese case. You want to review that just briefly?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. He was not directly influenced by that, but it certainly...
correlate.
They were certainly in the same... they were soulmates. As it turns out, Darley, he was on Darley's committee at Harvard. And, in fact, he was one of the reviewers. I saw this in the archives. He happened to be a reviewer for NSF for the grant of Latané and Darley. The grant proposal, and he approved it. So, yeah, clearly... in fact, he lists three major experiments that were he felt dealt with important conflicts in contemporary life. One was Ash's experiment between truth and conformity. Second, his own between authority and conscience. And third, Latané and Darley, which maybe I should mention since the listeners don't know.
Well, we should. Yeah, I want you to. Because this also is illustrative. It's illustrative of the difference between a large town and smaller, more intimate places. It's also illustrative of the ethical problem in research that we were talking about earlier, namely gross deceptive manipulation.
Right, but it's also, if I may add one other feature, it also illustrates the non-obvious findings of social psychology. You know, many people say, well, you know, what is social psychology? What's science? What's social science? Just testing the obvious. Well, it's not obvious, because what Latané and Darley found, they began with observing this notorious, sad Kitty Genovese case. She was murdered, stabbed repeatedly, and supposedly journalistic observation came to the conclusion that 38 people were aware of her being attacked. Nobody came to her help.
It was one night in the Bronx someplace.
Actually, it was in Queens.
People are looking out of apartment house windows, hearing her screaming down on the sidewalk, but nobody calls the cops.
Exactly, until much later when it was already too late. So that set everybody thinking, hey, how could this kind of callousness happen?
And so they started doing experiments on the streets of New York.
Well, actually, both the streets, but they started in a lab. But they took a different view. The common view was, hey, this is an example of the alienation, of the cruelty, of the indifference of one person and another in the city, how it dehumanizes, how the city dehumanizes people. So they flipped around and says, you know, we think, Latané and Darley, one was at NYU, one was at Columbia, says they had a different take on it. They said, you know, it may be paradoxically the fact that there are so many people around that led to the inaction of each person. Paradoxically, if only one person had heard her screams and knew that nobody else did, she may have still been alive. He argued that for various reasons, the group served to inhibit pro-social action for a number of reasons. One of them, for example, ambiguity. You know, if everybody's sitting around doing nothing, well, maybe she's really not in need
of
help.
So then they lay out somebody prone on the streets of New York, but they play many experimental variations. And what are they finding there?
Well, they found there was an inverse relationship between the number of people present and the likelihood of a naive subject helping. To give you one example, most of them were actually done in laboratory settings, although some were done in the streets.
But the dramatic ones are the ones on the streets.
Yeah, right. But the one that comes to mind right now was, well, in the street, the people would steal money, steal goods from outdoor stalls clothing stores, and nobody would do anything. But in the lab, what they did was one person was feigning an epileptic seizure, and he was either in the company of one, two, or three other people. And this was all an act. It was pre-recorded, and the question was...
So again, it's grossly deceptive.
It was deception. Yeah, you raised the issue of clearly it was deception, yes. There's no question about it. And it's probably in the same ballpark of severity as Milgram's work, I would say so. But what they found was that the individual in need of assistance was more likely to get help the fewer the other bystanders were involved. So that if only one other person heard this epileptic fit, the person would be more likely to get help than two, than three, and so on. So that, yes, that certainly raised problems of ethical issues and no question about it. It probably would be difficult to do that today.
There's so much more that goes on in contemporary social psychology. Some of that may come up as we respond to callers. We're going to stop right now for some commercials, then right on to the phones. 591-7200, that's the number. I see one or two lines available. If you want to pose a question or, for that matter, offer a thought, we welcome your contribution. Move quickly, 591-7200. Or if you want to reach us via email, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. We'll be right back and on to your contributions after these words. Our guest is Thomas Blass. We've been drawing from a very readable book and a very relevant one, relevant to all the many aspects of modernity and the confusions that follow from it. That is The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram, creator of the obedience experiments and the father of 6 degrees. They worked just about everything into the subtitle, didn't they?
Right.
And the publisher is?
Basic Books.
Basic Books. 591-7200 is our number. And if you've been trying to reach us, try again. We have one line available at the moment. And if you hit the busy signal, the proper strategy is to try again after we say goodnight to some prior caller. Here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. There was an interesting article a few months ago in the New Yorker that I thought was maybe a counterweight to this Milgram torture experiment. It was talking about military training, and that in World War II, if this article is accurate, a certain percentage of soldiers, even American soldiers, even having gone through basic training and so forth, at the point of their first combat experience, would refuse to fire their weapon at the enemy. They weren't, as this article described it, they weren't cowards. They would get ammunition for their buddy to fire, but almost at the moment of truth, they became pacifists. And the Army saw that and revised their training methods to the point where in later wars, the percentage of refusals dropped dramatically. But I just thought, is that the same 35% of the people who wouldn't shock people in Milgram's experiment, or is that something else that's going on?
I think it's something else that's going on. I mean, we're talking about a military setting which has rules of war, but you're talking about the work of Dave Grossman, who wrote a book on killing. And I haven't seen the New Yorker articles, but I suspect this is his work. Or, yeah, he pointed out that in the Civil War, when he looked at the muskets after battle, 90% of them were not fired. A higher percent were fired in the First World War, more so in Second World War, and finally, got up to 80-90% in the Vietnam War. What changed was the implementation of certain training principles involving conditioning, stimulus response conditioning. That is the creation of realistic targets. You know, flop over targets when you hit it, and it would fall over. So that before, in other words, training became such that it approximated more closely the realities of combat. If anything, actually, it really, in some ways, it's congruent with Milgram in the sense that people have a resistance to killing, and I think it takes certain external pressures to overcome that. Now, Milgram never had anybody kill anybody, and when he was asked directly, did anybody think that somebody died? He said, well, maybe somebody may have that, but certainly there was a question of whether they were conscious. So in some ways, it's consistent. In fact, Dave Grossman, if I may just take a step further, he quotes Milgram extensively in his book. It's called Killing, the Effects, something like on Society and something like that. But anyway, it's an excellent book. I interviewed him, actually, as part of my book, and I asked him, I said, you know, I see you quote him in his book. Do you think, has he had any impact on the military? He said it did, and it totally amazed me. He said he actually, when he was undergoing basic training at West Point, an officer's training, he said that he was shown training films on how to disobey illegitimate orders. And he called this a revolution in military history, which he attributed to Milgram's work and also to the tragedy at Mille Lacs. So, in a way, to come back roundabout, what effects do we see of Milgram's work? That's one of the beneficial effects, actually. Whether it has trickled down to the average, the untrained guard in Abu Ghraib, is another story. But he told me this. You know, can you imagine the military training people how obedience is such a central fabric of what makes the military tick? And yet, this is what they were taught. And he attributes this essay, this to Milgram's work, at least partially.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Well, thank you, sir. You know, though, what comes to my mind is something of a different order, or on the other side of the picture, with regard to military training. I think particularly of boot camp training for Marines at Quantico and places like that, where it's quite clear that the intention is to brutalize these men, to make them frustrate them and make life almost impossible in terms of physical demands, and to make them very angry at the insulting officer who is training them, the sergeant, who's the drill master who's giving them the training, and that that will somehow ready them, the theory goes, for doing the killing that they've got to do in situations of real combat. That is, I once did a little hitch at the Naval War College, which is a very different matter, and I was there as a civilian, in fact. But I talked to a lot of career officers, both Marine and Navy, and it's clear that there always has been a concern that you've got to take good kids and teach them to get angry and to be ready to do injury to others, or else they won't perform well and they will die in combat.
Also, to automatically obey orders without
and
thinking
to obey orders.
Too much about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. The brutalization, I'm not sure, but I think it probably helps facilitate acting adversely toward your enemy. But it's not totally clear to me why all that excessive brutalization is necessary.
It may not be necessary, but it has been.
But you're right. It is a reality.
In traditional military lore, that has been the approach to training, I think.
Right.
As well as training them to acquire some real skills.
Right.
Necessary combat skills.
Yeah.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. Some lines available if you've been trying to reach us, move quickly. We'd love to hear, for that matter, from some people who have had military experience and can reflect upon what we've just been saying. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Great show. I'm really enjoying it. I'm curious also about the 35% of people who are not obedient, who refuse to go along with the directive to shock the subjects. Was that group ever studied in terms of trying to identify common characteristics, either in terms of their personality or their backgrounds or gender? And could those characteristics be taught?
That's an excellent question, and it's we used to call this the $64,000 question. I guess today we would call it the $64 million question. Milgram himself never looked at it systematically. In fact, it's one of the downsides of whatever one's opinion about today. Actually, it's virtually impossible to do a Milgram experiment. If there was any rationale or value in doing one, is really to discover something about the distinctive qualities of those who defied. But there are hints in his work, and I listened to the transcripts of many of his experimental sessions. The hints come, for example, he says that in one of his interviews and also in his book, that people church officials, pastors, ministers, all of them disobeyed And somebody said, they all broke off, some with a sermon. He had some kind of sense of humor. Plus, also, you get a sense, again, that this is qualitative because you never did this in a quantitative sense. Just listening to some of the transcripts, I mean, it's kind of an eerie feeling listening to a tape of a session with a chair screeching as a person moves away from the table 40 years ago and the car's honking outside. But people who had a high degree of empathy, because some people broke off by saying, hey, I can't take that. I know I wouldn't want that kind of shock. And I heard that a few times. So there are hints there. I think a highly developed sense of empathy. I think a sense of intrinsically religious values seem to matter.
You know, relevant here is work done by others, by his mentor, Saul Esch, who did interview the nonconformists as well as the conformists in his little paradigm study, and also somebody that Stanley had some contact with. I learned from your book, I've had a little bit of contact with him as well, Serge Moscovici in Paris.
Right.
Both of whom, Ash and Moscovici, are interested in the deviant who resists pressures for conformity.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking also of Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence, and which he emphasizes the importance of the capacity to empathize and how important that is in terms of group, in terms of teamwork and people working in a business setting. See, so I was curious, was empathy an issue with the people who would not go along with the directive?
Right. I think logically, again, on the anecdotal evidence that I have from the few subjects that raise that issue, it seems to matter. And I also vaguely recall there was one dissertation, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but I'm almost sure that in one of the dissertations, and Milgram obviously spawned some follow-up, some others doing similar works. One later study did in fact show that empathy as measured by self-report measure, like a personality measure, did in fact predict the degree of obedience. But I'm saying this with some caution because it's been a while since I read that study. So certainly on logical grounds, empathy should play a role, but Milgram himself never tested it systematically.
Were they both males and females?
Yes. Oh, yes. To get back to that question, actually, yes. Most of his participants were male, but he had one condition in which all of them were female. He got exactly the same rate of obedience. Namely, 65% of the women obeyed fully as did 65% of the men.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was unexpected.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. A word more, if I may entreat this, about Moscovici's work particularly at L'École des Hautes Études in Paris.
Right. Well, actually, they were mutual admirers of each other, and it's interesting to see the correspondence with Moscovici. Moscovici was a maverick, and that way, I think that's why they had an affinity. Both of them were mavericks. Moscovici was one of the few people who made an early inroad into American psychology, American social psychology, for a long time until very recently dominated the field. He has this notion that, contrary to Ash, who argued that that the majority has an influence on the minority in a conformity pressure situation, he actually argues that a dissenting minority can have a powerful impact in swaying a majority.
The enigmatic phrase is a majority of one.
Well, a majority of one. I mean, it was actually a minority because he studied group settings of five or six people, and yet a persistent, consistent, idiosyncratic.
The great model is in the American film 12 Angry Men.
Exactly.
As you say.
Yeah, that's right.
Where Henry Fonda turns around all the rest of the jury.
I use that film all the time. That's right. Exactly. That is the prototype.
Yeah.
In fact, I show that in my experimental psychology course. It's a beautiful, powerful psychological study. I mean, it all takes place in the jury room. As you say, Henry Fonda. Initially, everybody's ready to hang this kid, and one by one, he brings him around to a not guilty verdict. The minority, the persistent, powerful individual swaying a majority.
I am swayed, as always, at around 15 minutes since the last commercials by the need to pause for these words. And we return to Thomas Blass. We are drawing from his excellent book, The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. Basic Books, the publishers. 591-7200 is our number, and we go to the next caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Thank you. I saw the movie about 33 years ago, and the thing that struck me most was not just the people who refused to follow the orders, but the ambivalence of the people who did, that the stages where people were really feeling that they didn't want to follow the order, and then they were assured they could, then it, I found more a comment in two ways. One, on the people themselves, their own ambivalence of doing something that they thought they shouldn't do. And secondly, what an important position leadership can play going towards the ambivalence to go and do the thing that is wrong or harmful, or leadership that would move people away from that sort of thing. But again, the thing that struck me most about watching that film was there was a real ambivalence between a lot of people. They could go one way or another depending on which way the leadership would take them.
I think it's a very good observation. And Milgram actually built in, as you know, prods that would, every time the subject would turn to the experimenter, you know, what should I do? I don't hear anything. The guy's screaming his head off, or I don't hear anything. He's totally silent. Please go on. The experiment requires that you go on. He had a prepared set of four prods. And that illustrates a broader point, which is most people, when they first hear about that work, say, hey, you know, we're much more sadistic than we think we are. Well, the truth of the matter is, the typical response was this kind of stop and go, stop and go. Most people didn't go blithely from 15 to 450 volts. They turned to the leader. They turned to the experimenter. They were ambivalent. They were struggling.
Absolutely. And that's what I thought was a good comment on leadership, too. The person the would power, say, I, he's a power of leadership.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Does that mark
a
real difference between what is being analogized in laboratory terms and the reality which Milgram had in mind, namely the Holocaust extermination process? Do we have any evidence that there was a good deal of hesitation and reluctance expressed by those SS troops who were involved in doing the killing?
I don't think we do, and I think that is one of the reasons why the analogy is not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the book Ordinary People. He does, in fact, that's one of the few places, and I followed the Holocaust literature to some extent. He actually describes a platoon that actually the leader took a very unusual step. He said, anybody who does not want to get involved in the killings is free to go.
The interesting thing on that, the police battalion 101 from Hamburg, whom he's studying about, reporting on in Ordinary Men, when they go into that first town in Poland to start the killing process, the top officer is a colonel, an older man, a reservist, who's been drawn up again, a veteran of the First World War, and he, when he reads the order, breaks down, goes off to a schoolhouse, which they commandeered as their headquarters for the day, starts drinking brandy and gets drunk, and refuses to come out of the schoolhouse. Mm. And one of his junior officers, a captain, expresses some contempt for the old guy, the colonel, and he takes over and orders the men to go ahead and do the killing.
Right.
I have one other, just a question.
Sure.
Where could I find a copy of this film? Because I saw it a long time ago and it's just fast.
Okay, it's the sole source is Penn State Media Services. You go online, you can find their website, and you can order online. Penn State Media Services. They sell that plus four other later films, but that's probably the most popular one. It's still available, as I know, as I believe, both in VHS and DVD form at this point.
And a terrific show. I mean, the stuff, I thought it was a hopeful thing that people were ambivalent, but they could lead either way depending on the leadership.
It is hopeful, and secondly, it really strengthens Milgram's argument, which is that the key element in what he's showing is the power of authority, not this kind of inner aggressive tendencies that we harbor and are just looking for an opportunity to vent them.
Absolutely. That's how I saw it.
Yeah, right.
Terrific show. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
What does the former captain of the Starship Enterprise have to do with all of this?
I hate to say this, but...
I have in mind...
I see what you mean. Okay. You're right. There's an interesting...
What's his name again?
Yeah, William Shatner.
Exactly.
William Shatner plays an interesting, unexpected role in Milgram's story. He, actually CBS made a made-for-TV movie called The Tenth Level. And the Milgram-esque, it was basically some dramatization of the obedience research and Milgram and the controversy surrounding it. It had heavy overlay of fiction, but there was some core truths in it. And the person playing the Milgram-esque character was William Shatner. I think this was between Star Treks. I don't know, but I have that film actually. It's interesting. The core truths there are there, but there's also a lot of fiction. For example, it depicts him having divorced his wife, which is not true. A lot of extraneous dramatic elements, fictional elements were thrown in there, but the core truths were there, namely a couple of things. Number one, the amount of stress that people underwent in the experiment, the gap, secondly, the gap between people's expectations and how far subjects would actually go, and the ethical controversy. sounding research.
Would you guess that this experiment is the most constantly taught in social psychology courses, the most frequently written about in texts, etc.?
Undoubtedly, undoubtedly.
More than the famous Lewin experiments.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Lewin is important historically, but there's no question because he's teaching us something that we didn't know. And it would be hard to, and it's very troubling. I think it would be impossible to find either an intro psych or social psychology text that does not talk about it. And interestingly enough, it gets talked about in other disciplines as well, sociology, political science. And what's one of the unusual features of Milgram's work is how he was able to jump over disciplinary fences. You go anywhere, like my book was reviewed in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was actually more like an essay review using the obedience experiment to alert physicians to the possibility of abusing their power. So you see all kinds of disciplines drawing on his on Milgram's work. And that's, I think, one of the distinctive features. But it's certainly, in social psychology, there's no question it is the most widely discussed and mentioned study.
We will pause for a last round of commercials and then right back to the phones and to some email. 591-7200, the phone number, and for email extension 720@tribune.com. I must read you, Tom, an email I've got here. It's a little lengthy, but it's worth reading.
Okay.
I once saw a bumper sticker that said, "I don't want any yes men working for me. I want people to tell me the truth, even if it does cost them their jobs." Great bumper sticker. A lot of words for a bumper sticker, though.
Yeah.
While obvious conformity is disliked, subtle conformity is in an organization is rewarded. A sycophant or a toady isn't attractive, but a, quote, company man or, quote, team player is valued in many organizations. Machiavelli wrote in The Prince that while flatterers should be avoided, a leader who has people contradicting him in front of others appears weak. He stressed that a leader should give others the chance to speak their minds in private. Did Milgram examine how people tried to disobey the instructions? Did they politely suggest to the authority figure that the shocks had gone too far? Or did they boldly defy the instructions? Just what are some of the untrue urban legends that have become attached to Milgram's experiments?
Well, you would have to actually look, analyze about 850 audio tapes, which Milgram never did. But there were, I would say there were as many different ways of breaking off as there were people. Maybe that's overstating it. But I was able to, he himself never studied it systematically. I was able to, let me just backtrack a second. He has his book, Obedience to Authority and Experimental View, has among the various systematic presentations, quantitative presentations of the conditions, he has 10 vignettes of individuals and how they behaved, obeyed or disobeyed. And so you get a flavor of the variety of ways that people handled the very, very high-pressure situation. So, that's how he talks about it, via a description of these vignettes, how they broke off, how they continued, some how readily they continued. Some you get a sense of brutality. Some people saying, well, we don't, you know, we saw this in Germany. And somebody, in fact, who came from Germany says, we just too many people have suffered, and I'm not going to go on. So there was no uniform way. He did not talk about this in any systematic fashion other through than the vignettes.
I was wondering, Tom, do you know the work of Rudolf Rommel, the political scientist, who has studied genocide?
What's the last name again?
Rummel, R-U-M-M-E-L.
No.
He's a political scientist at the University of Hawaii, of all places, who for years has been doing demographic study of the populations of countries around the world, birth rates, death rates, the missing people, locating missing people by statistical demographic work, bearing not only upon the great Holocaust of World War II, but all the other destructions of people because they're in one or another category, not only racial or religious, but they could be in class categories or what have you, or ethnic categories, but where, as a matter of state, more or less, people are destroyed.
Mm.
He defines this not as genocide, but as democide. Genocide is a subcase of democide, where the principle on which people are destroyed is their racial, their socially defined racial identity.
Mm-hmm.
His estimate of the number of people killed by, as a matter of state, given in his book, Death by State, is in the 20th century.
Mm.
And the book was published in around 1990, so it misses some later developments. His estimate at that time was that about 180 million people had been destroyed by, quote, legitimate authority.
Mm.
And that required others to obey legitimate authority in doing the killing. Now, he involves, it treats a broad range of cases. For example, the starvation of the Ukrainians as a systematic undertaking during Stalin's years is listed as democide.
Mm.
They were a resistant class, resistant to collectivization. It served the Soviet government to get rid of them and to get all the wheat they had raised and sell it for international credits at that particular time in the early 1930s. But what he makes very clear, even before the Balkan democides of recent years in Bosnia and in Kosovo, and before Rwanda, though already the Cambodian genocide had occurred, what he makes very clear is that there's a broad penchant for this sort of thing to happen, and happens with authoritarian governments. The only control that works against it is the presence of a free public that can respond by expressing their anger and their revulsion when such orders are given.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you should be reading the book, but I should note one thing. We have to understand what Milgram tells us and what he doesn't tell us. He does not speak to situations where there's a coercive authority who has to be followed at a cost.
This is just a guy in a gray coat at jail.
Right, and that was one of the revelations, that here is a person who had absolutely no coercive means at his hand. And yet people, once they accepted, the key element was accepting his right to dictate my behavior.
I guess one other study that you mentioned in the book that we haven't yet discussed tonight is worth mention at the moment and relating it to all that we've been saying. And that's Phil Zimbardo's prison simulation at Stanford University.
Right. Well, Zimbardo and Milgram were actually soulmates, as we used to call them. They were very much on the same wavelength. Both of their works speak to the power of external situational pressures. There were some similarities. There were some differences. The similarity is the unexpected transformation that takes place in normal people.
What happened at Stanford?
What happened at Stanford, he took approximately 20 normal American university students and created a mock prison in the basement of Stanford University.
Right? All male, I believe.
All male. He had pre-tested them, did some testing in terms of mental health and past drug use and all kinds of stuff. Normal, everyday college students. Randomly, by the flip of a coin, they signed half of them to serve as guards, half of them as prisoners. And although it was role play, it was pretend. It wasn't. It was different than Milgram. Milgram had involved, as you mentioned before, deception. This people knew that this was make-believe, and yet the situation took on an unexpected reality, so much so that got out of hand, became so brutal. The guards became, they were just given vague instructions, but they grew into their role, into becoming very sadistic and brutal. Those who played the role of prisoners became very servile, with their only goal and wish is to get out. How do I get paroled? The reality overtook them rather quickly. The bottom line is, it became so brutalizing that although he had planned to continue this for 2 weeks, he had to end at six days because two or three of the prisoners actually suffered emotional breakdown. So the dynamics were somewhat different. There, we're talking about not authority. We're talking about, because it was group pressure. It was the solidarity. In some cases, the guards tried to slip into the guard role as a way of expressing themselves to their peers and maybe showing off to their peers. But it was the role that defined their behavior, or what the participants saw as being required by their role. Zimbardo was kind of a distant authority. He didn't stand over them. This kind of played out in itself. If anything, the dynamics there were much more of a peer pressure sort, as opposed to Milgram, where we're talking about a hierarchical organization. There was a hierarchy too, but there was a much stronger group element, group pressure feature that played a role in Zimbardo.
Even in those days, Zimbardo wore his sort of satanic black goatee.
Oh, yeah, he's right. But he was hip-looking with there's an early film of him. And he's a wonderful person, actually. He's been very helpful with my sharing information and very supportive.
We go back to the phones. Working a few more quick calls. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, Milt, I apologize for getting in the conversation late, but I wanted to discuss what you had to say about the Marine Corps boot camp.
Yeah.
First off, officers go to Quantico, Virginia, and Marine Corps boot camp is in Parris Island, South Carolina, or
right.
San Diego.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. I went through Parris Island in 1971, and I have to say I didn't see physical abuse. There were some physical liberties that were taken at times.
What do you mean by physical liberties?
Where they would find a way to over-exercise you, for example.
Yeah, wear you out, sure.
For example, by the time I had gone through, Congress had already passed laws about how much they could exercise you. And the law said you only had to do 10 push-ups. But the law was defined as 10 good push-ups. When they got 80 guys doing push-ups at one time, they're going to find somebody that's slacking off.
Did the drill instructor deal in standard insults?
Yes. Yeah.
Telling you off all the time.
In my opinion, how I define what was done in boot camp was they broke you down and rebuilt you to what they wanted.
Well, that's what I was saying before.
Built up your confidence to a level that, you know, far exceeded what you were before.
Yeah, Semper Fi. We've got to stop. We're almost out of time. I thank you, sir, for that call, and my apologies to those who are still waiting on the line, but time is rushing us towards the very end. We've got about 2 minutes left. What have you learned? Has being a social psychologist altered your sense of human nature and of the social order in which human nature expresses itself? Is there a wisdom that flows from all of the social psychology that you and I have been involved with for many years?
That's a tough question to summarize in 2 minutes. I think we learned that people are much more ready to give themselves over to others. We are social beings. We are much more greatly affected than we think by the presence, active or implied presence, of other people. Sometimes that's for the good. Sometimes that's for the bad. The person who exists by himself, we actually look down on people like that, lonely hermits in the extreme. We're social beings, and depending on the situation, our responsiveness to our social environment can end up with positive results, sometimes with negative results.
And it isn't all pre-patterned by the first 5 or 10 years of life.
Is it pre-patterned?
It is not pre-patterned.
Not necessarily. I mean, it's part of it, but I mean, there's certain predispositions that may draw people to certain groups, for example. But certainly, it can be overridden in some instances by the immediate pressures, the concrete situation people find themselves in. And in fact, one of the, I think, truths of social psychology is that we often, there's a wide gap between what we think we might do in a concrete situation and what we actually do.
Mm-hmm.
People like to idealize. People just cannot predict their own behavior. And that's one of the constants that runs through social psychology.
And then in extremity, you learn the truth about yourself. Or you learn some new truths about yourself.
Right.
We are out of time. Our guest tonight has been Thomas Blass, who is professor of psychology, of social psychology at the University of Maryland, and the author of this fine book published late last year, The Man Who Shocked the World, The Life and Legacy of Stanley Milgram. Basic Books, the publishers,